Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a recall of condoms in the state of Utah. Also, a key export city for Utah mines says it will phase out coal shipments. Utah's process for approving personalized license plates gets scrutiny after multiple people complained to the DMV about a controversial vanity plate. And Salt Lake City's mayor announces new emergency bed space for the homeless for the winter months. And joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham. Thanks for being here, Matt.
Good morning.
Also, reporter Aaron Alberty is in studio with us this morning. And good morning to you, Aaron. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
On this snowy morning. And George Pyle, thanks to you for making the trek as well.
It's not a fit night out for man or beast, but yeah, we're happy to be here.
And we are here to provide our weekly local news recap. You are invited to join us with your questions and comments, and you can do that by calling 801-355-8255. You can also go to KCPW, our Twitter feed, and tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. There's also some news in the governor's race, the impeachment trial, a great deal of more that we could cover, but here's where I want to start. I want to read from a list of slogans. Put your arch into it. Enjoy your mountain, toss the Jell-O salad, and explore Utah's caves. Aaron Alberty, I won't ask you to translate any of those, but there is a Utah news story that ties all of those phrases together. What's that story?
the health department, in conjunction with several partners, began a HIV awareness campaign, and as part of that, they got a bunch of condoms, 130,000 condoms to be exact, with labels that riffed on kind of various Utah memes with sexual innuendo.
Including greatest sex on earth, et cetera, variety, that those that I just read as well. And these were phrases on the packaging. This campaign, did it originate in Utah? I mean, is this something that only happened in Utah? I thought there were a couple of other states that had similar sort of campaigns trying to highlight HIV awareness, correct?
Yeah, Utah's not the first state to have, a condom distribution campaign with state-related condoms on it. It's new here.
Utah Governor Gary Herbert, it turns out, was not read in on this in advance, and he wasn't a fan of this campaign. So he took action. What did he do, Aaron?
He ordered them to stop the distribution, but about 42,000 condoms had already been distributed to various sites around the state. These were going out to everyone from like clinics, nonprofits, activist groups, even like social clubs, bars, you know, resource centers, all sorts of things, trying to reach generally at-risk populations seen as at risk for contracting HIV. About 40,000 had been sent out already when Herbert ordered them to stop distributing. So as of yesterday, the health department was scrambling, trying to chase down the 42,000 condoms that had been sent hither and yon throughout Utah.
All right. What was the objection that the governor had to this campaign? And maybe actually, Aaron, you should start by telling us who organized this campaign, how it came together. And that's it.
The campaign was funded by grants from the CDC and, lots of parties that are involved in patient advocacy and HIV awareness were involved. Universities, the Utah AIDS Foundation, et cetera, along with the health department to create this campaign. And it's not just condoms. The condoms were kind of what part of the advertising, but there was going to be billboards, social media advertising, and an informational website with all sorts of facts about treating, caring for, preventing HIV.
And then again, as we said, the governor wasn't a fan of the campaign. Does that mean that in addition to the condoms themselves and the packaging that had these sort of cheeky phrases on them, is the rest of that campaign going away as well? The billboards, the website, et cetera, everything you just described?
Well, the whole thing has been suspended. As of yesterday, like the informational HIV website had been turned into a black screen with temporarily offline, and that's all you could see on it. All of the facts about HIV and prevention were gone. It's not clear, whether that's a direct order from Governor Herbert or from elsewhere in the health department. Publicly, Governor Herbert hasn't said anything about, like, the website. His objections that we know of are to the condoms.
So this campaign, or at least as far as you say, in conjunction with the distribution of these condoms, is over before it even starts. What does the Utah Department of Health say about all of this and the fact that the, you know, the kibosh was put on this campaign that they had probably spent a fair amount of time and effort on, right?
Not much at this point. They haven't had a lot to say about it. Honestly, the first question we got from nearly everyone was, well, what's going to happen to these 130,000 condoms? And they don't know. They said they don't have a plan. We're just scrambling to get them back. So they had 130,000 on order. Not all of them have been distributed yet, but they don't know what they're going to do with them. As for the rest of the campaign, the advertising and the website and whatnot, they said that that's been suspended temporarily. They said they hope within the week they can get it up, but they really don't know. But the entire campaign is under review now.
I did see them, you know, the department's Twitter account apologizing for this, for what it described as a lewd campaign.
Yes, they said that the condoms, the labels on the condoms were lewd and offensive.
Okay. So
they said that they were retracting them because they had not gone through all of the necessary approval channels. I asked, what are the approval channels for a campaign like this, and which one was missed? But they wouldn't reply to that. So
okay, I'm just going to remind listeners that we'd love to get your thoughts on this campaign. Was it just too sexy? The number to call is 801-355-8255. Let us know what you think. George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. I mean, is it did this campaign cross a line for Utah?
Well, I guess it didn't, according to the governor of Utah. So you could think that's representative. I've got this brand new conspiracy theory right now that the whole thing, the fix was in from the beginning.
To give it all of this
attention.
Yeah,
because, I mean, we did the story and about these condoms are now being distributed. They have these risque phrases on them to get people's attention, to get them talking, to get them thinking. Hopefully thinking. You know, thinking and sex don't always go together, and that's the fight the health department is up against. And we did the story, and it went around. And then the story that the whole thing is being canceled this morning is in the Washington Post, the Guardian, the BBC, newspapers all across the country. I mean, it probably would have gotten some attention without the change of heart. But the fact that it's been canceled and withdrawn is getting more publicity for the whole thing than if they just left it alone. And so I'm kind of wondering if maybe that was the point from the beginning. Maybe the governor was in the loop. And this whole idea was to say, we'll distribute these. Then you get offended and call them back. And hell, we'll be on the BBC.
Maybe. I mean, the amount of attention that this has brought to it is kind of curious. Whether or not that was the intent, that seems to be the effect.
That's been the result.
Though, unfortunately, now they've turned those condoms into collector's items, so people won't use them if they have them.
They're going to frame them. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, they say they want them back. I mean, one thing it would seem to me that you don't recall is that you don't want back, although, yeah, you're right. I mean, there are people tweeting that they're collector's items.
Right.
So if you want to get the money back the CDC's money that we spent, if you want to raise even more money, then yeah, auction them off to the highest bidder as collector's items, you know, a full set. We'll be way ahead.
Aaron, just before we, you know, move on to other stories, are there any other groups who are taking the idea that the health department had and running with it, meaning there's artwork out there, there's a full campaign that's been developed? Anybody else, you know, deciding to maybe sell these for a small fee, or, you know, I don't know.
They're the property of the state at this point. I do know that a lot of people had suggested just give them to the Utah AIDS Foundation, let them just distribute them as they see fit. And I know that the Utah AIDS Foundation was actually very enthusiastic about that suggestion. They said that their clients and their participants would be very excited about them. You know, the Utah AIDS Foundation was part of this campaign, and they said that having these provocative messages on the condoms, you know, it's not just to get attention. I mean, it is to get attention. And the fact that people are all over social media asking where they can get these condoms and saying these are cooler than, you know, the store condoms and everything like that, that's a big success. It's a prevention tool, ultimately, if people are excited to use and, you know, be comfortable with the use of a prevention tool like this, that's a big win. But he said also, you know, one of the reasons that these provocative messages are seen as being effective is they're trying to do outreach to at-risk communities, and people who don't like the messages likely aren't the people who most need the prevention message, he said. You know, they're taking this to people who are at risk of contracting HIV and people who are sexually active. And if talking about sex or making sex jokes is uncomfortable for you, maybe you're not in that population.
The target audience, yeah.
But alternatively, he said that, if the state has its imprimatur on these kind of body jokes, it signals to people who might otherwise be uncomfortable asking questions or talking about sexual health that Utah's a safe place to do that. And by withdrawing them, that just reinforces the idea that Utah is so prudish you can't bring something like HIV up. That's what the AIDS Foundation guy said.
And conceivably with real world consequences. If the 40,000, 42,000 condoms that have been distributed are brought back, I mean, we don't know whether or not the state might then hand over the whole 100 and however many thousand.
Really don't have a plan. I mean, the health department said they're just scrambling. They will regroup after they get as many condoms as they can back.
Okay. George Pyle, any final comments on this
one? Again, it almost sounds like this was a fix, but I think probably looking back, it would have made more sense for a private organization like the AIDS Foundation, that's not a government agency, to get the grant directly and do the whole thing itself with no state participation. And that way the state doesn't have to worry about doing something that's offensive, because if it's the state speaking with our tax money, then you could understand how you might say, well, that's different than a private organization, a nonprofit, a for-profit, anything, handing out the same message.
It's the health department.
I think the governor made the wrong call on this, unless he's part of the plot. But, this is kind of the thing where you almost kind of have to think to yourself, okay, we're going to do this. What is the headline in the paper going to be?
Can I just add something real fast?
Matt Canham, yeah.
The points of information we have that undercut George's conspiracy theory that this is a plot is that providing condoms was a tiny part of a organized campaign, which included an information website and TV ads and radio ads and billboards. And if all of that stops, that would be really disheartening. This is the first time this state has had a coordinated HIV campaign ever. That's kind of surprising to say. And so you have people like Senator Derek Kitchens, who's obviously far more liberal than Governor Gary Herbert, when he read Aaron's story about them trying to recall this and taking the prevention website down. His tweet was literally unbelievable, absolutely infuriating. At the end of the day, we got to realize, like, funny messages and a condom is a part of a much bigger effort that's trying to stop people from a horrible disease.
Okay. There is other news to get to from this past week aside from the condom story. But I'm going to invite listeners to join us again. The number to call is 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. And Aaron Alberti, I want to stick with you with some other news that involves controversy in the state of Utah. It's not quite as playful, but you covered this. This is a photograph of a personalized license plate and a number of complaints to the state on the grounds that this license plate was offensive. Maybe tell us just where this starts, some online uproar over a photograph of a license plate.
Yes, a Salt Lake City resident took a picture of a vanity plate, a personalized license plate that said deportum, as in deport, the word deport, and then the letter M after it, posted it on social media. It was circulating. Some state lawmakers weighed in, and there were people that were unhappy about it. The state has rules, forbidding vanity plates that express contempt, ridicule, or superiority of, any race, religion, ethnicity, various protected groups. And people were arguing that this license plate is a violation of that. The state has put it under review. But then a number of people, well, four altogether, contacted us at the Tribune and said, well, I complained about this license plate before, they were all left with the impression, because they didn't have any follow-up, or in one case, one person in 2018 was told it would be recalled, that their complaint had led to the taking back of the license plate. So when they saw it come up now, they were not that thrilled.
Right. There have been complaints about this before, and there was some expectation that something would have been done about it. You wrote that as a result of this sort of controversy from this resident, Matt Pacenza, posting these on social media, that the process itself for approving, or not for approving, but for when these challenges occurs, is changing at the state level. Can you tell us how that process is changing?
Yeah, the DMV says that the reason that these complaints stalled out is that someone along the line of the chain of command just didn't think it was offensive or in violation of the state guidelines, and so that the complaints just kind of died there. Now they said that they are going to be communicating complaints to kind of everybody at once that's able to see it, so it doesn't stop with one person in the chain of command. But also, if a license plate is subject to more than one complaint, that it will be taken like under further review, I believe at the AG's office. So.
And the rules on plates, you said they can't express contempt, ridicule, superiority of a race, religion, deity, ethnic heritage, gender, or political affiliation. This is in your story. How does it? That's probably a lot. Here's the question I have, really, Aaron, is the amount of money that the state pays on the whole program that is personalized license plates or vanity plates, are they paying for it with the money they get by people who are, is the program worth it, I guess is the question. And that's not a question for a reporter. Yeah.
I don't know what the total of the fees versus the total expense of personalizing plates is. I mean, I think it costs like $61 to file an application for a vanity plate, because I was trying to see, what went into it.
Sure.
But, this has raised questions among a lot of readers who have said that, if you're going to ban some of the ones that the department has banned, for example, they have rejected applications for words like cowgirl and cheese and coffee, but allowed to port them. And then you'll see on the website today, we have a story that somebody has had previously complained about and successfully got recalled, a license plate that said Führer, as in mine,
as in Hitler, not as in uproar.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And that was approved by the DMV in 2019 in the spring. So, if we're going to ban words like cheese and coffee and cowgirl and base camp, but allow deportum and Führer, then, people have questions like, should we just ban them all or allow them all,
George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist, is this why we can't have nice things?
I'm pretty First Amendment free speech absolutist, but a license plate is issued by the state. It is in a sense the state speaking. The state isn't telling you that you can't have racist bumper stickers or Nazi stick figures on your window. But when it's something that was made and issued by the state of Utah, license plate, then I think there is reason to say where there are limits. We're not going to allow you to use our metal press to say something that's offensive. Well, that's the easy part. The hard part is what's offensive. And especially in, license plate pig Latin, where sometimes you have to kind of think for a minute and decode what it might mean.
Yeah.
Now, of course, as an old headline writer, my first thought was this guy ran out of room, and what the license plate really ought to say is deport me. But he fell short. It's like when the Onion they went back and did front pages for all through history, and for the day that World War I broke out, in giant letters it said WA, and then they didn't have room for the R, so
big.
It was just a little hyphen there, like see page 3, and so the guy ran out of room. It's always going to be problematic. There's always going to be human beings in this loop who are going to look at it, and somebody will find offensive, somebody won't get it, somebody won't even see what the reference might be. Maybe somebody looked at this and didn't decode it and didn't understand what it meant.
Yeah.
I think if the process becomes a little more open, and anytime there's a challenge, more than one person looks at it, then it might clean up. But we're always going to have trouble with this because people take some pride in sneaking these through. It's not just like Fuhrer or things that are obvious dirty words that'll get rejected. There'll be all kinds of little codes and twists, and you pronounce it this way or that way, and you go, oh, I see. And
right, and you might, and then you have to stay up on all of the coded language that has to do
yeah,
with,
you gotta be
with
on the internet,
white supremacy or whatever the
stuff.
Thing is.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really interesting to think about that there is, and it's not just one person's job, Aaron. We're going to go to a break here in a minute, but this isn't just one there's no vanity plate czar who makes the final call.
They get hundreds of vanity plate applications every month. And they have like an 11-person staff that does a bunch of other things too. I mean, they're not just like the license plate people.
Yeah.
There are a lot to go through.
You wrote also there's this sort of parallel but separate challenge to certain rules inside of this whole process having to do with license plates promoting guns. Can you just quickly touch on that?
Yeah. One of the things that some people in the legislative committee that heard about this week had talked about was a new provision that would allow the DMV to consider an official state position, and this comes back to the legislature has designated an official state firearm. It's a Browning semi-automatic pistol. I can't remember the number, but anyway, there have been some fans of said gun that want a reference to that gun on their license plate, and they've been rejected because they don't allow references to weapons on the license plate. So. What they're saying is, well, you know, the state has formally declared this the state gun, and we can't put it on our state license plate. So that's the argument that is being made now.
Okay. And that's sort of entirely separate from this specific conversation about the license plate that read deport.
Well, it would be kind of a narrow change in the rules because, you know, the state hasn't taken an official position on a ton of things that are, like, outside of the guidelines. I mean, maybe they have taken a position on cowgirls or coffee. I don't know, but we'll find out.
All right. You know what we do? We need to head to our first break in the show, unless we're missing anything from the story. Aaron, is there any final thoughts on a piece of this that maybe we don't know about?
You know, in the story that we have going up today, we do have a conversation with the ACLU about some of the First Amendment limits and considerations as to whether these plates should be allowed or banned. And it really does come down to, you know, does it have the state's kind of force behind it?
Okay. That's Salt Lake Tribune reporter Aaron Alberty, and we are going to take a quick break in the show. When we come back, we will turn to some new emergency shelter for people experiencing homelessness here in Salt Lake City. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, reporter Aaron Alberty, and Editorial Page Editor George Pyle. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you are invited to join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweeting to @KCPW. Matt Canham, in the paper this morning is the news that Salt Lake City Mayor Erin Mendenhall took some action on an item she said she'd take quick action on after being sworn in as mayor, some gaps in the system that aims to help people who are homeless. The mayor yesterday evening announced a new site for temporary emergency shelter. Where is this going to be, and what do we mean by temporary?
This is going to be on Highland Drive at what used to be a Deseret Industries. That is an old building owned by the city, and hasn't been used for a couple years now for any sort of full-time purpose. With just $5,000, they believe they can get this building set up for 145 cots as a what they call a low-barrier overflow shelter. Essentially, our new mayor believes that anyone who asks for shelter should be able to get it. And she's taking a step that the people who created our new system to serve people who are without homes refused to take. When they got rid of the emergency road home shelter downtown, They created three smaller, what they call resource centers, which combines shelter with other services, and reduced the capacity by 400. So there's 400 fewer people who could access this existing services. The idea, though, is that the new system would help people through the process in a more coordinated way. And what that means is you're assigned a bed. Well, what happens if you don't show up or if you come late? You still can keep your bed. And what it means is if you show up and ask for one and there's not a bed available because it's already been assigned to someone, they told you to go to a warming center where you sat in a chair and were not allowed to sleep. And they would have people who would wake you up if you tried to. There wasn't enough capacity. And the former mayor and the other people, including our lieutenant governor, and we're just saying, look, we'll we're going to try other means, but we refuse to do an overflow shelter. Mayor Aaron Mendenhall has a different idea.
And that different idea is this, again, this temporary space. It's with $5,000, you said they're going to put cots in. They're not—
From the Red Cross.
The Red Cross is providing cots.
There'll be security guards, and there'll be a shuttle that goes from here to other homeless services, because obviously Sugar House is not where there's a lot of services for people who are homeless.
Right. But so this is a stopgap, and especially to help people over the winter months when, there's freezing weather outside.
The intention is this would close on April 15th. I mean, clearly our system— these smaller shelters took too long to be built and opened. And so there is still hope that if you can move people out of homelessness, maybe you need fewer spots for people who are homeless. That's still a hope.
Right.
We'll see if that works out. There was not enough time to get that going this year. And so that's why there's talk of at least of a temporary shelter this winter. But who knows what will happen next winter?
I think you already touched on this a little bit, but how would a person make their way out to this space? And is it for anyone?
It appears to be for anyone at this stage. There are some details that need to be worked out. This is going to open sometime next week, supposedly. And I think the idea is if you ask for shelter, then they will find you a spot. Now, that means, let's say you went to the men's shelter in South Salt Lake and they didn't have a bed. I think the idea is they would find you a way to get to here. They're going to close the warming center. So these chairs where people have been not allowed to sleep, but at least could get warm, that facility is not going to be used for that purpose anymore. Those people who come there will be shuttled here. How the actual coordinates, I think there's some details that still need to be worked out.
And we mentioned cots, we mentioned security guards. Will there be a sort of staff? Is that another detail that we're waiting to see, who will actually be on hand?
I mean, I think the mayor, when she made this pronouncement yesterday, she did it in conjunction with the city council. So it's a coordinated government action. But the city council still needs to vote today to approve this use, to provide some money for this. How this fits in with the rest of the system, or is this just a Salt Lake City action? I think we need to learn a little bit more in the coming days.
Okay, so vote today, Friday. In the run-up to the launch of the new homeless resource centers that, again, are not temporary, there were some residents of this neighborhood of Sugar House who effectively shut down plans for a resource center to go into their neighborhood.
That's correct.
How are neighbors in that neighborhood responding to this announcement, or is it too early to tell?
Well, we talked to Landon Clark. He's the chairman of the Sugar House Community Council. I will say reporter Taylor Stevens, who covers this for us,
right,
talked to Landon Clark. And what Landon told Taylor Stevens was that people are a little worried because they don't know what happens after April 15th. Is this actually temporary, or will this continue? And Sugar House is near Fairmont Park, Sugar House Park. Parks are places where people who without homes tend to congregate. And he worries that those parks will become magnets for people who are homeless. And he would like to see that not happen. There was a huge outcry before. At least in the early hours after this was announced, there isn't a huge outcry. There's this slight worry. But it might be that we're a little farther down the path when it comes to changing how we deal with people who are homeless and how we give them the services that we think they need. So that might be part of it. It is something we'll be tracking.
I noticed on Twitter some homeless advocates lauding this move. Bill Tibbetts from the Crossroads Urban Center, for example, who was glad to see a new warm place for people to sleep. George Pyle, you know, just on the as a columnist, somebody who writes about any number of news issues that occur in our capital city and elsewhere and in the valley and the state and beyond. It's quite the prelude. What do you think about this move from the mayor and the council?
Well, I think it's the right thing to do. I think that Aaron Mendenhall said during the election and between the election and her inauguration that she was going to get stuff done in a way that she implied hadn't happened in the last 4 years. A lot of people were concerned that shifting from the road home to these three new service centers was going to leave a lot of people quite literally out in the cold. And we as a newspaper said, well, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, Matt mentioned the schedule didn't quite keep, so when the new system came into place, it just happened to be winter. If the road home had closed and the new centers had opened in April, then you would have had, you know, a little time to get through and work out some of these bugs and everything. And people might be on the street, but they wouldn't freeze to death. Now, this is a stopgap. It's admittedly a stopgap, which is necessary. I think they're doing the right thing. They're going to have security guards. They're going to have rules. They're going to have to watch and make sure that they haven't done something that the neighborhood is going to object to, but they have to do more. And this is case. I mean, we've talked about this before. When you transition from one system to another, there's always going to be some bugs. There's always going to be some things that are left out, and this is an effort to try and close that gap. But you know, when back in the 70s, when they said, you know, mental hospitals are awful, let's close all the mental hospitals, we'll take care of them in the communities. Well, what we're seeing is people who are mentally ill who 50 years ago would have been in a mental hospital, which might have been an awful place, are now on the streets, and we're not taking care of them. We phased out the old system, and we never really powered up the new one.
Okay, but so there's the stopgap measure, as you said, and a way to help people through the winter. I don't know the behind-the-scenes conversations on this, but it is kind of interesting how quickly this came together, and I guess what I'm getting at there is, does that quick movement have anything to do with the close relationship between the mayor and the city council, or am I stretching on that, Matt Canham?
I mean, I think there's always a little bit of a honeymoon period when we have a new chief executive of the city. But this also is not a surprise for any of the city council. Mayor Erin Mendenhall, when she ran, signaled her support for this,
okay,
called for an emergency shelter, was critical of closing the road home downtown this winter because she was worried that people would not have a place to go. So I'm sure when she was inaugurated recently, this was a quick conversation and a scouring of city property of what made the most sense. And she decided this was the place that made the most sense.
Okay. And this is a story I'm sure that we will hear quite a bit more about.
Definitely.
Let's turn now to another story from the Tribune out of California with implications for the Beehive State. Richmond, California, it turns out, is where a lot of Utah coal, after it gets mined, is sent to be exported overseas. Richmond is the latest city to take action to try to get itself out of the coal supply chain. What's happening there, Matt Canham?
This is a fascinating story with implications from Utah to California and our coast to Japan. Richmond is a city that has a terminal called the Levin Richmond Terminal, which is deep enough that you can bring a ship and put significant weight on that ship, and it can then sail to Japan. So what happens now is Utah's coal country trains coal to multiple spots in California. These ships start in the city of Stockton, where they are loaded to the weight that they can be in that smaller terminal. Those ships then move to Richmond, get topped off, and then go to Japan, which wants Utah coal. Well, for Utah coal mines to continue to survive, it needs this sort of export to a foreign country. Because in Utah and in the United States, we're moving away from coal. So this is how Utah coal is going to survive. But the problem is these cities on the coast don't want to be places that have coal. The city of Richmond voted unanimously to stop this terminal from using Utah coal. And it's because they believe coal dust is coating their streets, is making people have health problems. And what they've done is it was a unanimous vote for a 3-year phase out.
Okay, it's not an immediate halt.
It's not an immediate halt.
What does that mean? I mean, what does that mean for Utah coal producers and how they might ship their coal out?
So Utah coal producers and the state of Utah supporting those coal producers have put considerable money about trying to find more places to do this. They've talked about places in Washington. They talked about Oakland. They've talked about places in Mexico, like near Tijuana, where we can build a terminal to ship Utah coal out of. They have not been successful yet, and they are in the process, or they potentially could lose this resource as well. excuse me, but the state has put $50 million
aside, right?
Aside, with the idea that they would help build a terminal in Oakland. And that's still in litigation, but seems like it's going to have some real hard time moving forward.
And again, it's in litigation because, as you said, Oakland said, no, we don't want to have coal coming through our community.
We don't want trucks carrying coal to be rumbling through our city.
Hmm. Okay, so maybe Mexico is sort of according to Brian Maffley's reporting in the Tribune, that's a potential spot.
That's a potential spot, and there's efforts in Washington State as well. None of them seem to be moving very fast. And what's going to happen here in Richmond is significant litigation. This terminal and the union workers who work at that terminal are going to sue. The Wolverine Fuels, which is the company that operates most of Utah's coal mines, they're going to sue. At least that's what they've indicated. They're going to try to make it so this terminal stays open.
You wrote about, you mentioned the implications for Japan. Brian Maffley wrote about the fact that the tsunami that hit the Fukushima nuclear power plant and the effects on that have a kind of cursory or connected role to why Japan is as interested as it is in Utah coal.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you think about Japan, obviously it's not a place where we're 100% familiar, but you don't think of Japan, you think of coal mines in Japan, which means they have to get it from an ally. And then Japan and the United States are close allies. And Utah has what they consider to be relatively clean coal. Now, I know that environmentalists roll their eyes at that kind of term, but some coal burns dirtier than other coal. And
I guess it still has the same impact in terms of climate change, in that it's contributing the same amount of greenhouse gases. It just might have less soot. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so Japan has decided that Utah coal is desirable, and Japan is willing to put considerable money behind a terminal on the West Coast. So not just Utah, but energy organizations in Japan want to fund this so we can have a conduit between Utah coal mines and Japan's energy sector.
Mm-hmm. This is really a fascinating story, and there's so many more details to it. Is there a big chunk of it that we are missing out on before we head to our final break of the show and come back for our underplayed stories, Matt?
Not now. I would say, well, the one thing I would say is Wolverine Fuels wants to expand coal mining in Utah. They don't want to just keep the mines that are currently there going. They want to start new ones. That doesn't happen if they don't solve this problem.
Okay. That's Matt Canham, Senior Managing Editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. George Pyle, I didn't give you an opportunity to comment. Do you want to weigh in on this just really quickly, the different cities that are turning down Utah coal exports?
Well, I'm sure that if the state of California or some cities in California wanted to try and tell Utah or some cities in Utah what they could and could not allow and what they could and could not ban, I don't think we'd be real happy about it. The cities in California, these particular cities, don't want coal shipped through their cities. And I think that they're going to probably win that. And we're going to have to look for something else to do besides mine coal or uranium. I mean, they're laying off the San Juan County. It's not owned by the county, but it's in San Juan County. A uranium mine down there is laying off a bunch of people because there's the demand for U.S. uranium is going away. I mean, certainly Japan doesn't want any more uranium after their meltdown. So it's just the extractive economy is dying. It's just a question of whether it will die first or we will.
George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. We're going to take another quick break. There's still more to come, including our underplayed stories of the week. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Aaron Alberty, Matt Canham, and George Pyle. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255. Senior Managing Editor Matt Canham, let's squeeze one more story in here, a story of politics and the race for who will lead the state of Utah as governor. Some interesting news on one candidate vying for that spot, Thomas Wright, who is the former Republican Party
chair.
First he picked up an endorsement of someone well-known in Utah politics, and then that story kept unfolding. What happened?
I don't understand, honestly, what happened, but I will tell you the details that I do have here. U.S. Representative Rob Bishop, who has long been in Congress, has decided to step away from that position. He's going to retire. He considered running for governor himself, decided he was not going to do that, and he was going to endorse his friend Thomas Wright, who is a real estate agent in Park City and previously ran the party. Well, yesterday, Thomas Wright announced that Congressman Rob Bishop will be his running mate. And why this is surprising is we have not seen a person who has been elected to high office himself run as the lieutenant governor of someone who hasn't.
Right. The more seasoned political player here is Rob Bishop.
You tend to be the top of the ticket when you're the more seasoned political a person who has a fundraising network, who has more name ID. Like, it would make sense for Rob Bishop to be running for governor and Thomas Wright to be his running mate, but it's flipped here. And exactly why is hard to tell. Even when video interviews, for anyone who knows who Representative Rob Bishop is, he has a very dry sense of humor. He's very flippant. So when he describes this, he describes himself as old and Thomas Wright as young, and that there's some sort of energy difference here maybe, but I don't know. This is a weird one.
I don't, I'm not certain where to go with it. It's an interesting choice for Thomas Wright. It maybe increases his profile. Have any of the other candidates announced their lieutenant governor choices yet?
No, and it's highly unusual that anyone names their lieutenant governor here. But I do think it's a savvy move for Thomas Wright, as this is a field that has six candidates in right now, and Thomas Wright was not considered to be in the top tier. Getting someone like Rob Bishop, who could be a surrogate, who could be at campaign events, who could help spread his message, gives him two people out there working when everyone else just has one. And so as someone who's trying to come from behind and make a name, I think this might help him.
George Pyle, the sort of unlikely ticket there. I mean, the ticket itself isn't necessarily unlikely. It's the order of the ticket.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's like maybe Rob Bishop thinks that this guy will get elected governor and then get appointed ambassador to someplace, and then he'll get to be governor without actually having to run for governor. It's like when George Wallace put his wife up for governor when he couldn't run anymore, and everybody knew that he'd really be the governor. So I don't get it. Rob Bishop has kind of left me a while ago anyway. Yeah, as Matt said, he has this kind of puckish sense of humor. Maybe he just thinks this is a joke.
All right. Well, there's so much more to announce in the race for governor, and a slate of candidates, who are running, and as a result, a slate of candidates who are going to announce lieutenant governor, partners pretty soon here. And you've got the presidential election and other races coming up this year. It is going to be a year that tries all of our patience, I'm sure. Thank you very much for that coverage, Matt Canham. Let's turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. This is our final segment where we maybe highlight a story that didn't get play, or that just we didn't get to talk about on the show today. And Aaron Alberti, I'll start with you. What's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Zach Podmore, our Report for America reporter in San Juan County, earlier this week had a story about the Sutherland Institute's role in the campaign to roll back Bears Ears National Monument, which ultimately did happen.
Right.
And just the extent of the influence of the Sutherland Institute, and also the role of its funder, the God Family Country. Am I remembering what it's called?
GFC, God Family and Country, I think.
God Family and Country. It's a really, really interesting look at the players in this.
Involves some pretty well-known donors from the right, the Koch brothers. There's it's a really interesting story that
It is.
that you should definitely check out at sltrib.com. Thank you, Aaron, for picking Zach's story for underplayed story of the week. Matt Canham, what's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
Our Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr is tracking all things impeachment. And for Utah, that means he's keeping a close eye on Senator Mitt Romney, who is one of the few Republicans willing to step out of the mainstream view of his caucus. And that includes wanting to hear from witnesses in the Senate impeachment trial, such as former National Security Advisor John Bolton, who has said he would show up if subpoenaed and says he has new testimony to provide. Many other Republicans in his party don't want to hear from John Bolton at this trial. Now, this is such a high intensity effort in impeachment. So what Tommy is writing about includes that there are outside efforts to influence the senator, whether that is on the right or among Republican groups who don't like the president, who are attacking him for or pushing him to stay on his position to allow witnesses to come. What Tommy's story, which I think is fascinating, shows that in this crucible, Mitt Romney is losing Republican support and gaining support from Utah Democrats. There's a poll out from, it's called Morning Consult, and they do this rolling quarterly poll of all senators. And Mitt Romney lost 18 percentage points from Republicans and gained 9 percentage points from independents and even 4 percentage points from Democrats.
Does that speak to Republican support in Utah for President Donald Trump?
It speaks for Republican support in Utah for the Republican position on impeachment. Whether that is actual support for the president, at the very least, it's support for not removing him from office.
And then the final question that I have on this is, you know, do we have any sense of where Mitt Romney might go? I mean, might he be influenced by this kind of polling, to tell you the truth? That's a question you can answer.
He's going to get pressure and intense pressure going forward. What we're going to see is the impeachment trial starts on Tuesday, and this will be a few weeks. It will be more than a week before the Senate decides to vote on whether someone like John Bolton will appear before them or not. Does Mitt Romney hold that position? It will take four Republican senators to vote with the Democrats and independents to get those witnesses there. We'll track him. Thomas Burr will be all over it.
Okay. Check it out at sltrib.com. George Pyle, we'll move to you now for your pick for underplayed story of the week. I know you don't like the title.
Well, if it's underplayed, I haven't seen it, is my complaint. So I do, in case you missed it. And even though I should be doing a Tribune story, this is just broke this morning, just Friday morning as we're recording this. We are learning from Politico, among other sources, that Ken Starr, the prosecutor of Bill Clinton, the special prosecutor who went after Bill Clinton, is going to be one of the defenders, one of Donald Trump's defense attorneys in the trial before the Senate, as is Alan Dershowitz, a retired Harvard law professor who kind of used to be considered more of a liberal and now has been in defense of the president and on Fox News and everything. I mean, both of them accused of either participating in sex crimes, or in the case of Ken Starr, being fired as president of Baylor University because of sexual scandals that went on during his administration, not his direct responsibility, but at the football team and,
right,
and other things. So he was forced out of that position. Probably the most interesting comment on this is something I can't read on the radio, but if you follow Monica Lewinsky on Twitter, as you should, she summed it up very nicely.
Okay. Check that out on Twitter. I've not seen it, and now I'm dying to find it. For my part, I will go with – did anybody see the Jazz game last night? No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I'm gonna, it was a tragedy. I'm going to skip that and actually mention the announced retirement of Utah Democratic Representative Patrice Arendt. She's been in the legislature with one four-year gap since 1996, and you can read all about her announcement and about all of the stories that we have been covering on the show today at sltrib.com. And George Pyle, Aaron Alberti, and Matt Canham, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that wraps up Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks, as always, to KCPW's Jesse Ellis and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan for their help. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local shows through whatever podcast app you use or at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great weekend.